Playing a couple tunes from the recently departed Harold Mayburn, one of the best hard bop piano players out there at the age of 83. We're going to hear Blues for Phineas Newborn, with Lee Morgan, Idris Muhammad, Buster Williams, George Coleman, and Hubert Laws. Harold Mayburn, right now on Battlefield Earth. Thank you.
Thank you. So, ladies and gentlemen, tonight I have the wonderful opportunity of interviewing jazz pianist Harold Maber. Harold, can you tell us how you first started in music? I know it was a very long time ago, but...
Well, I always tend to say that music chose me. I didn't choose it because of the fact that I'm self-taught.
Okay.
I never took piano lessons, unfortunately. There was nobody in my family played music, you know, in my immediate family.
Okay.
However, I had a lot of uncles and cousins who sang in the church choir and stuff like that.
Okay.
But I started one day at the age of 15. I heard a young girl playing a song on All the Black Keys. We used to call it I Stuck My Dolly in the Mud. And I went up and played the same song, just, you know, like that. Then I kind of learned how to play a song called The Honey Dripper.
Okay.
And then when I went to Douglas High School, I wanted to play an instrument, but I couldn't get a sound out of the trumpet, so I played drums, and they switched me to baritone horn.
Wow.
And okay. I transferred to Manassas High School. That's when I met Frank Strozier.
Okay.
And Professor Garrett, D.D. Bridgewater's father, Matthew Garrett, was our teacher. He was a trumpet player, so he taught me, Booker Little, Frank Strozier, George Coleman, Hank Crawford, Lewis Smith, Charles Lloyd, Isaac Hayes, a few others. So he said, well, maybe you ought to try the piano. I said, well, I really don't know how to play the piano. So I just kind of, he showed me a few chords, and I just kind of picked it up little by little.
Yeah.
But I really didn't get into it all the way until I left Memphis and moved to Chicago, and that's when I really, you know, got into it.
So when you moved to Chicago, I understand you played there in the late 50s.
1954 to 1959.
Okay, and what were some of the groups you played with?
Well, the main group, it was three main groups there during that time. They were making what we call hit records. Ahmad Jamal's trio, Ramsey Lewis trio, and Walter Perkins' group called the MJT Plus Three.
Okay.
And there were three or four different groups.
But
I played with that group. The group I played with was much more successful, commercially speaking.
That's
Frank Strozier, Bob Crenshaw, Willie Thomas, Walter Perkins. And there was a trumpet player named Bobby Bryant had written a song for us called Sleepy, and it really turned out to be like a jazz hit.
Okay.
10,000 copies. And then after we left Chicago, we came to New York because we had work in New York at Berlin and different places.
That's great, yeah. So you were already successful before you came to New York.
Well, as successful as we could be. In other words, we had a little reputation. People knew about Cannonball, knew about us and Miles because they would come out of to see us rehearse, you know. So we had a little name. We didn't come to New York just totally unknown. Yeah,
that's wonderful. So you always tell us the story of one of the first nights you came, something about your first night in Birdland.
Yeah, for a true story. First night in Birdland, I was going to Birdland. And Cannonball was standing out in front of the club, unfortunately taking a cigarette break. I said, unfortunately, because you know the cigarettes are rough. But anyway, so he saw me and he said, hey, Big Hands, you want a gig? I said, sure. I thought he meant with him, so he took me down to Birdland. So Pee Wee Marquette, like the Major D guy, looked up at me and said, where you going, Papa? Called everybody Papa. Where you going, Papa? So Cannonball said, well, he's with me. So Pee-wee said, well, tell me something, because this Birdland, you don't come walking in no Birdland like nobody knows about you down here. So this was a Tuesday night. True story, man. Harry Sweets Edison was playing with this quintet with Tommy Flanagan, Jimmy Forrest, Gene Raymond, and Elvin Jones. Tommy was getting ready to leave to go join Jay-Z's band. And then on that Tuesday night, everybody was there. Red Garland, Cedar Walton, B.L.E., Quincy Jones, Tommy Flanagan, Bobby Timmons, Cannonball, Bill Russell, oh, you name it, man. And Hank Jones was probably coming over later because he was on staff at CBS at their Southern show.
Okay, so you were there at the right place at the
right time. So yeah, but I still had to play the song. Sweet, he introduced me to Sweet. So Sweet said, you want to play? I said, yeah, man, I'm nervous, shaking. He didn't ask me, what do you want to play? He said, Habit, 8-bar introduction, 8-flat. I said, what the heck is Habit? So I knew how to play 8-bar introduction, so I played 8-bar introduction, and Sweets came in. The song was getting to be a habit with you, old standard.
Okay.
So I kind of fumbled the first course, second course I had. He said, you got the gig. He hired me on the spot.
That's great.
And I came right back to Chicago.
Okay.
Worked 2 weeks at the Blue Note.
Okay, great. Yeah, so after that, you know, you went on to work with some really great names, including, you know, Jimmy Forrest, obviously.
Right.
And you worked with Lionel Hampton.
Right. That was my next big gig, Lionel Hampton, when I came back from Chicago.
And how was it playing with Lionel?
It was very interesting because it was big band, and I was kind of felt good because I had played with a big band in Chicago, Morris Ellis Big Band, so they gave me a chance and the experience that I need to read some kind of music. So yeah, it worked out good.
Okay, that's great. Yeah. So, you know, then you moved on, you know, you worked with Donald Byrd.
Right.
And then eventually Miles.
Right. That came in 63. I was working with Roy Haynes, and then I played with Betty Carter at Birdland for 2 weeks. And then that's when Miles called and, you know, wanted me to make that tour with him.
Okay, yeah, and I know it was relatively short, but could you tell us about some of the things that you learned or heard from him, or some of the experience you had?
Well, it was quite a gig. The only thing is, during the time, Miles was into the Motor thing, which was cool. He's playing 251, but during that time, I didn't really have a real concept of the Motor, which involved a lot of the clusters and stuff. And I mentioned that Professor Mogul Miller, he said, well, look, man, there were a whole lot of piano players that didn't quite understand it, but I look back at it now, and it seems so easy now.
Yeah,
but he was
very
supportive of me, and he said, you sure can swing. Well, anybody tell me that I can swing, that's a compliment to me. If they say I can swing and or comp, then I don't have no problem with anything else.
Well, Miles Davis.
You know, but we had a quality 6 weeks with Ron, Frank Strozier, George Coleman, Jimmy Cobb, and then Tony Williams, and Herbie got in the band after I left the tour.
That's great, yeah. So, and then later after that, you worked with J.J. Johnson?
Right, shortly after that, 1963, I worked with J.J.
Okay, and
we did a beautiful record together called Proof Positive.
Great. So, and then one of the other major names you played with was Lee Morgan.
Oh, yeah. That was my man.
You know, I'm a great fan of your work with Lee.
Right.
Could you speak to people about Lee? You know.
Well, he was a trumpet genius, man. He understood everything about music. Facet. He could have been a great classical trumpet if he wanted to, because anything you put in front, he could sight read it.
Okay.
Not a perfect.
Yeah.
And plus, you know, he was great at writing great compositions with great titles. Plus, he'd do a lot of dates, and at the end of the day, they might need one tune, and he'd come up with a hit like Sidewalk. That was on the spur of the moment.
Yeah.
You know, last tune, they need, you know, and when we did the Gigolo, we need another tune, and he came up with the arrangement on You Go to My Head.
A lot of musicians still play that.
He was a musical genius, man, and he treated me so good. He let me record my music, you know, that gave me a chance to build my publishing up. He recorded Benny Hopper's music, Benny Maupin's music, Jimmy Mayer's. He was a very unselfish kind of person, man.
That's wonderful.
He was really wonderful.
Yeah, and I remember, this might be a little difficult to talk about. You said you were on the gig the night that Lee Morgan passed. Could you speak a little bit about your experience after that? You know, because I know, could you tell people from your perspective what happened that night on the gig, because I know that must have been
very painful, without going into details, because I try not to talk about it. But after that happened, because nobody knew anything like that was going to happen, but after that happened, man, I was my stomach, my whole system was messed up for a whole month to see something like that happen, because we had played a good set and there was a lot of snow on the ground. And that was one of the reasons why he didn't get a chance to survive, because it took so long for the ambulance to get there. Normally, they could have been there in 2 or 3 minutes, but because of the magnitude of the snow, it took so long, you know. But man, it took me a long time to deal with that, because to see that happen to somebody that you're so close to, you know.
Yeah.
And we went to his service in Philadelphia, and I'll never forget, rest his soul, Kenny Durham, man, bless his heart. He was sick then. He checked himself out of the hospital to go to the thing to attend Lee's funeral. That's the kind of camaraderie that the guys had then. It's not like that with a lot of younger cats now. Those guys loved and respected each other. You know?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, Lee is personally my favorite trumpet
player. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, obviously he's coming out of Clifford Brown.
Right.
But, you know, Lee, to me, just has this wonderful blues feel and behind the beat feel, but
very charismatic, just like Miles Davis. That's why Miles done it, because he was a trendsetter.
What do you think was your favorite session with him? Because I know you made a few.
Well, I would say my favorite is the Gigolo, man, because that's the only time I recorded with Wayne Shorter. That's the only time. And since Wayne was on it, because Wayne, as you know, is such a wonderful human being, and Lee loved Wayne, so I would say that's one of my favorites, because of the fact that Wayne was on a date. Then naturally those dates at Live at the Lighthouse and The Procrastinator and a couple of other ones, you know, and the last one we did, you know.
But
I would say the Gigolo, because it was we had some good moments on that day, you know.
Yeah.
That's the great Harold Mayburn playing with Lee Morgan on the Gigolo album. Ah, he was so good. Big Hands, they called him. Played with Miles, George Coleman, Sonny Rollins, everybody. Everybody wanted a piece of that Big Hands. Harold Mayburn passed away at the age of 83 the other day. And we hope that he rests in peace. Battlefield Earth rolls on. Here's Bob Dylan. Tell me that it isn't true. Battlefield Earth.
He's tall, dark, and handsome, and you're holding his hand. Darling, I'm begging of you, tell me that it isn't true. I know that some other one holding you tight. It hurts me all over, it doesn't seem right. All of these awful things that I have heard, I don't want to believe them. All I want, so darling, I'm counting on you. Tell me that it isn't true. All of these awful things that I have heard, I don't want to believe them. All I want is your word. So darling, you better come.
Quite sure why everyone still wants to listen to Leonard Cohen, but here he is. Something from the album The Goal. It's called The Goal. Leonard Cohen, Battlefield Earth.
I'm going down again, but I'm not alone. Settling at last the counts of the soul. This for the trash, that paid in full. As for the fall, it began long ago. Can't stop the rain, can't stop the snow. I sit in my chair, I look at the street. The neighbor returns my smile of defeat. I move with the leaves, I shine with the chrome. I'm almost alive, I'm almost at home. No one to follow, and nothing to teach, except that the goal falls short of the reach.
yeah. Everything gonna be all right this morning. Oh, yeah. At the age of five, my mother's child gonna be the greatest man alive. But now I'm a man, way past 21. I want you to believe me, baby. I have lots of fun. I'm a man, I'm a full-grown man. Not your born lover's man. I'm a man. I'm a man. I'm a man. Man child. Oh, yeah. Man. I'm a full-grown man. Just me and my mate. You know I made the moon, honey. Come up 2 hours late. I'm a man. I spell you H-I-N. That rubber band man. My mother's child gonna be the greatest man in life. I'm a fool for now, I'm a man. Way past 21, I'm a natural boy. You got to believe me, honey. I'm a rolling star. I have lots of fun. That man, no be, but now I'm a man. Oh, child, why? That mean manish boy, man, of a not a bone lover's man. Well,
Fine-tipped tweezers, like these. They work much better than blunt-tipped tweezers or your fingers alone. You can do this yourself or ask a friend to help. Before you start, clean your tweezers with a little rubbing alcohol on a cotton ball. Now, grasp the tick where the mouth is attached, which isn't always easy to see, especially on ticks the size of poppy seeds. But if you gently lift the tick with your tweezers, you can see that it's attached like a hinge. That's how you can tell where the mouth is. Get as close to your skin as possible with your tweezers. Now, pull in a slow, steady, upward motion away from the skin. Don't twist, jerk, or wiggle it out. Your skin will pull up as the tick detaches, just like when you pluck a hair. Afterward, clean the bite site with rubbing alcohol and a little antibacterial cream. If the mouth parts stay in the skin, you can either leave them alone or try to remove them with tweezers as you would a splinter. Keep an eye on the bite site for 30 days, watching for any kind of rash, including the telltale bullseye rash for Lyme disease, or for flu-like symptoms such as headaches, muscle aches, or fever. If any symptoms do develop, you'll want to see your doctor and make sure to let him or her know the date and location of the bite. Remember, not all ticks carry disease, and your risk for disease is greatly reduced if ticks are removed promptly. Knowing how to safely remove a tick can help keep you safe from tick-borne disease. Learn more at health.ny.gov/tick-free.